The Guardian.
It's a crisp morning here in Research Triangle Park in North Carolina. An uninspiring place name, but it belies how fascinating this place really is. It's the biggest science park in America, nestled between the towns of Chapel Hill, Raleigh, and Durham. 3D ultrasound was invented just over there. IBM is based here, and Duke University is not too far away. This is a special Science Weekly podcast. I'm Alok Jha, and I'm heading to the Sigma Chi Research Center. For the next few days, it'll be a meeting point for hundreds of scientists, students, journalists, librarians, bloggers, programmers, and anyone else interested in how the web is changing the way science is communicated, taught, and carried out. I'm going to be looking at how the relatively new medium of blogging has evolved over the last few years, and ask, what role does it now play, and where does it fit into modern science? I'm also here to find a man who's steeped in blogging legend, an enigma. This slippery character goes by the name Bora, and from the evidence I've unearthed before coming to North Carolina, he appears to spend 24 hours a day on Twitter. There he promotes, encourages, and makes sense of the ever-increasing number of science blogs. Is he real, or just a sentient software application? My mission is to find this mysterious man.
I was pleased to see Bora just before the conference started, Bora Zivkovic.
Bora Zivkovic is the sun in our sky.
If you could imagine all of science as some sort of giant spider web, he sits in the middle of it, feeling the vibrations of every strand.
Bora Zivkovic is the spark that started the chain reaction.
I'm Anton Zeicher. I'm one of the organizers of Science Online 2011. This year we have 300 people registered. We ended up with about 150 people on our wait list, so lots of people wanted to come. So we had a live streaming, which has allowed other people to watch. The people who are here this year come from quite a few states in the U.S., come from the U.K., from Ireland and Italy, and even someone flew in from Malaysia this week to attend.
So it's a unique network of people, and it's an extremely fertile, excited atmosphere intellectually.
It sounds quite serious and important. Is everyone here serious and important?
Well, not at all. I also come because it's one of the funnest, merriest, mischievous conferences I go to. There's a great age gradient. There's a lot of young people, a lot of people who are, by its nature, attracts people with new ideas and who are willing to experiment and take risks. And very, very lively, very fun crowd.
Why do I blog? Because I can do whatever I want on a blog. There's no proposal that you have to write. There's no editor who says, this isn't good enough, but I'm not sure why. It's just you and your scratch pad.
I really like a lot of science. It's in my field, but not directly related to what I do. Things that I know about and I like, and I find really cool studies or really interesting research papers, and I want to explain them so that everyone finds them as cool as I do.
I blog because as a feature writer for Wired Magazine for 14 years, I was very frustrated that I would write stories that would take 2 months to research and 1 month to report, and then, you know, another month to print, and so there was this time lag between what I knew and what my readers knew. And the great thing about blogging is that it allows me to respond to the breaking news environment.
I started blogging just on my own on a blogger site and felt kind of isolated. I'd been doing that for 3 years, and then my book came out, and on the strength of that, I was invited to join Science Blogs, which almost immediately had an ethical implosion. So I left Science Blogs and then became part of a sort of extraordinary reorganization of science blogging in the summer of 2010, in which Science Blogs blowing up was kind of like a puffball seeding the forest floor of the blog ecosystem and creating a whole bunch of new networks.
I've used my blogs mostly as a writing laboratory to pick questions or ideas and just play with them sort of out in public and see how that goes.
You can experiment. You can see, well, can I use videos like moving illustrations? And so it's a bit of a laboratory. Again, it's a great freedom to take a break from more conventional stuff like newspaper articles.
It is a different way of communicating. I think that while a lot of magazines and newspapers have opened up their articles for comment, I think that as a blog, on a blog, your voice, yourself as a person becomes a little more apparent. And I think that that is what really brings people in and encourages them to engage with you.
Basically, I started because I was forgetting stuff. And I thought, well, I'm going to take good notes now. So I sort of remember things that I read. And there was software to do that when I started. And it was basically the same software that runs a blog.
You can write about things that obsess you, and maybe other people might become obsessed as well.
I wish I'd gotten serious about blogging earlier. For a while, I just put up pictures of my cats and sort of ranted a little bit. And a blog isn't a thing where you have to write in a specific way, in a specific format. You can use it to do almost anything in terms of science writing. I wish I had realized the power of that.
I think it's very important that people be able to see what scientists are like in real life and how excited we are about our work, because, you know, most people have this perception of science as being kind of full of people who are very analytical, and we are, but we're also funny and weird, and what we do is really, really cool. And I want people to know, like, what we do is awesome.
These people clearly love what they do. It's done in their spare time outside work as scientists, journalists, or teachers. It's a sort of collective communication effort for everyone's benefit. But is anyone really doing anything new? Is there anything here that a good science reporter on a mainstream newspaper hasn't been doing for decades? There might be more coverage, but is it any better?
I'm Maren McKenna, and my blog is called Superbug. I'm one of the slate of bloggers at Wired.com. I write about scary diseases, basically. I started blogging really for very practical reasons. I had been a newspaper reporter for a long time, and then, like a lot of newspaper reporters in the United States, I didn't have a job anymore. And at about that same time, I signed a book contract. So I started blogging. First, because I wanted to kind of declare my turf on this topic that 3 years later I was going to bring out a book about. When you're a newspaper reporter, your name appears in front of people fairly regularly so that they know what you're interested in and what you're writing about. And I was just about to kind of disappear from people's view. So blogging gave me a way to keep putting myself out there and having a public discussion about what I was interested in. Blogging gave me a chance to transform my writing, to walk out of that sort of exquisitely even-handed third person, not very excited about anything tone that newspaper journalists are obliged to have, into a first person, passionately engaged, personal voice that is not only essential for a blog, but was necessary for me to learn in order to kind of go forward with the rest of my journalistic life.
And how does that fit with writing about science, which is supposedly an objective, you know, not non-person-based affair?
Well, so the mistake we made in newspapers was to think that being objective or being fair is the same thing as being dull. And the thing that blogging taught me is that it is possible to be objective about science and interestedly critical of scientists, and yet be wildly excited about what they're doing. I never would have found the tools or the room to do that had I stayed in newspapers, but it was blogging that taught me that it was possible to have that kind of voice.
My name is Steve Silberman. I'm a freelance journalist from San Francisco and a longtime contributor to Wired magazine. My blog is called Neurotribes, and it's on the Public Library of Science. So I come from a really writing and literary background, whereas a lot of scientists who blog come from a science background. And I think in the emerging ecosystem of blogs, we both have a place. I have, in the course of a long career, I've done a lot of in-depth reporting, and that's not something that we really expect from bloggers in general, but I know how to do it when I need to do it, and I wouldn't expect a scientist to fret and worry about the surface of the writing as much as I do as a writer, but we both need each other.
You've been at the conference now for two and a bit days. It's been quite intense. What are some of the sessions you've really enjoyed?
Well, I was just on a session called Maintaining the BS Filter. That was really good because there is a lot of terrible science information out there in the mainstream media, and the bloggers are really working out a way of helping to correct for that. I was on a session yesterday talking about the lessons of ClimateGate. That was a very interesting and provocative session, talking about some of the problems with disinformation.
The traditional media is run with a certain amount of certain expectations, certain story templates, certain limitations. There are wonderful things about the traditional science media, but you can do a lot of things online on your own blogs that is not so easy to sell to mainstream publications that tend to want what's the latest finding and what's significant about it and when can we buy it at the drugstore. I'm David Dobbs, and my blog is Neuron Culture. It's one of the Wired.com science blogs. And another thing it's added, we saw this, you know, recently in the hubbub over the arsenic paper that we talked about on the podcast a few weeks ago. Instead of just having science journalists write about a paper and relay the findings to the public, you had science journalists interacting with scientists, trying to interact with the scientists who did this paper, interacting with other scientists who had critical things to say about the arsenic paper. Really rich, rapid vetting and conversation about this paper that had a tremendous educational value, I know for a lot of journalists.
I'm Brian Spitek. I write the blogs Laylaps and Dinosaur Tracking. One's on Wired Science, one's on Smithsonian. And I'm a research associate at the New Jersey State Museum. I work on fossil crocodiles, sort of the monsters of the ancient Jersey shore, my specialty. I think one of the most important things is that we can be media watchdogs. We just had a case where some fossil teeth found in a cave in Israel were said to be the oldest Homo sapiens fossils ever found and more than doubled the range of the species. And that turns out that was just something that was extended from a press release, and it didn't say that at all in the paper. Myself and Carl Zimmer jumped on that immediately and were able to dig into that into detail why that happened. A lot of sort of post-publication peer review is happening on blogs now. We just had the whole arsenic life controversy where you're having the scientists talking to each other on these blogs. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of blogging. It's something that's available to everyone. It's a tool that can be used in multiple ways. And I think it's a very direct way for scientists and science enthusiasts and science journalists to get these stories out to the public in a meaningful way, in a more detailed way than you might get in your average like 500-word news report.
I think blogging, if it's done right, is very powerful. If somebody doesn't like a scientific paper and writes a blog post that's clear and compelling and detailed, they can have a huge effect. My name's Carl Zimmer, and I'm a science writer. I write books, newspaper articles, and I write a blog called Loom. With the arsenic life, there was a biologist, Rosie Redfield, University of British Columbia, who really got the ball rolling and started to articulate what a lot of scientists were feeling. And so it can have a huge effect that way. You know, in a conventional newspaper article where you're constrained to space, in a case like arsenic life, you could go to talk to some experts and see what they think, and maybe they weren't so crazy about a paper. You might be able to get one quote in, a short quote, and then a quick paraphrase of their objections. When I wrote a piece about arsenic life for Slate, where I was talking to a lot of people who really didn't like this paper, I wrote a standard article, but then a day or two later, I went to my own blog and I just said, look, a lot of these people sent me very long emails, and I'm going to post them all because I want you to see how seriously they're taking this. They're not attacking this paper carelessly. They've read it, they've thought about it, and they've written 1,000 words to me about it. And here they all are. And you can do that on a blog because there's no limit.
We are so clueless about biodiversity, and yet we share the planet with these things. So it's a really scary and strange thing in science that we have overlooked so much.
Well, I'm just at the back of one of the many lectures going on here. That's Meg Lohman you can probably hear in the background. Oh, still no luck in finding that Bora chap, by the way. Everyone keeps telling me I'm just missing him. Maybe he knows I'm looking for him.
Bora Zivkovic, Bora Z, Coturnix, is a shadow.
Bora is the really tall guy with the coolest glasses.
He's the glue that holds the science blogging community together.
Bora Zivkovic is a force of nature. He is a walking quantum mechanical explosion of enthusiasm.
For malaria and other extraordinary discoveries, but we have
now look around a typical research lab, and you might end up depressed at how few women there are hunched over the experiments, or the number being elevated to senior university positions. But that gender bias seems to be leveling out at Science Online, where more than half the attendees are women. It's not always plain sailing, though, through the sometimes murky, often anonymous world of online comments. One of the sessions here is dedicated to the perils of blogging as a woman, and the dilemma of whether to keep your name a secret.
My reason for being a pseudonym is actually because I am an animal researcher, and I get issues associated with that. I need to protect my work and the work of my colleagues. But I think being a woman in science is also somewhat difficult. I really, one of the things that's great about being a pseudonym is that people read me for what I say. They cannot read me for what I look like because they don't know.
My name's Carmen Drawl, and I'm a reporter at Chemical and Engineering News magazine. It's a weekly, and I have a blog called The Haystack, which I share with Lisa Jarvis. We blog about the chemistry and the business of pharmaceuticals and biotech industry. I've been very lucky myself that I haven't encountered very much adversity at all. I've encountered very much support. I think that women bloggers do have a lot to overcome. One of the things that came up in the session was the issue of friend bias. Things like awards in blogging and selection for some of the more prestigious networks has everything to do with who you know and what you write about.
I think this is a really interesting question, because though I blog under my real name, for the entire time that I was a newspaper reporter, I wrote under a slightly different name. I used my initials. I was M.A. J. McKenna, so I had a gender-neutral byline. And I did that because when I first started writing about science and medicine, my editor said, you know, we just think you would be better received if people didn't know you were a girl. And I didn't actually sort of come out to who I was until my first book came out 6 years ago, and my editor said, well, you're going to write about these disease detectives. People will think it's probably cool that it's a girl writing about the disease detectives. So then I became Maren McKenna for everyone to see.
One of the many things that we need to overcome is tokenism as well, making it more easy for someone to feel like they're not being selected to come to this blog network or for this award because they're a woman.
I have not yet had any negative repercussions from that. No one has attacked me on the basis of my gender. No one, I think, has thought less of me because I am a girl writing about science. And also, no one has... I haven't had any inappropriate contact from people.
I mean, it does happen, though, doesn't it?
It happens to people all the time. And it's just, I don't know, good luck, and maybe I'm jinxing myself to say that I haven't experienced that yet. But what I do experience is that there just aren't that many of us, us being women writing about science in the public sphere, compared to men. The sphere of women bloggers about science is inarguably smaller. And what we do to encourage either female journalists or female scientists to come and join us in the party is something that I think a lot of people are talking about here.
Sexism sort of gets looked over when it's slight, when someone says, oh, wow, you know, great post, by the way, you're really hot. I'm Christy Wilcox. I'm a freelance science writer, blogger, and a graduate student at the University of Hawaii. You know, other male bloggers don't, you know, Ferengula and anybody else, nobody gets, oh, you're really hot as a comment, whereas a female blogger might. And there's potentially, as a woman, you're just more vulnerable to someone deciding if they hate you enough. If they were to do something, you're less able to defend yourself in certain ways.
Paper 20 parsec course. There's a lot of variation in this other figure. I don't know the truth, but he says a 20. Instead of 12 parsecs, it would be 20. Hate to show my dorkiness, but here's... You know.
So, wait a minute. This is getting quite serious. Probably time to lighten the mood ever so slightly. Let's bring on the comedian. He's just told a great geeky joke. Ever heard the one about the neutron that walked into a bar? He got all his drinks for free. The bartender told him, for you, there's no charge. Well, it's all about the delivery, isn't it? Anyway, they're currently lapping up a Star Wars gag.
But now this is really good. This is on Boing Boing, and someone says a bigger problem is the parsec is a term specific to the orbit of the Earth. So, he goes, I'm not sure how or why this particular unit of measurement would be used in a galaxy far, far away. To which someone said, to be fair, it was a long time ago.
My name is Brian Mallow, and I'm a science comedian. I'm based in San Francisco. Science comedian, what does that mean? They might have preconceptions. One might be that anyone they've heard trying to be funny with science before has been really bad or corny, and so sometimes they're like very leery of the concept. And other times, sometimes they're like, oh, a science comedian, does that mean you're going to make fun of us? And that's not really what I do. I don't mock scientists and I don't mock science. I love science. I don't know what it is. I just find humor within it.
Annoying nerd boys, it's science fiction. It doesn't have to be percent 100 accurate. Half the things in science fiction don't exist. Nerd is happy that other nerds think he's the nerd king.
We've heard from the writers and the journalists. Blogging is a seriously good way of reading about the latest research. But how useful is any of this for the scientists that do it? Does it help their careers? Do they get anything but a shiver of pleasure from it?
I'm John Hawks. I'm an anthropologist from the University of Wisconsin. My weblog is John Hawks Weblog.
You're a professor who blogs. There aren't too many of them. Has it helped your career?
It's made a big difference in my career, both because people have become aware of what I do, and because of the nature of work I do a lot of genetics, a lot of modeling, and I rely on collaborations with other people who are doing sequencing. And so to have it be, you know, sort of evident what I'm interested in has brought me a lot of collaborations. But the other thing is that it's just brought a lot of attention in a positive way to my lab, to the work that we do, and to the field as a whole.
In general, it does not help my career, and I don't expect it to.
Do you think that the role of science reporting in the mainstream press is diminishing rapidly given the rise of this rich ecosystem of well-written analysis on science?
You know, it's interesting, because I think that there will always be a role for reporting on the new thing, because there are new things. What becomes more difficult to predict is, you know, some things that are new because they got published, but they're not really very new. And what blogs have been able to do is to sort of draw attention to the fact that the artificiality of the, you know, press release on this new thing that's published. And I can't say that the science has really changed as a result. You know, I think that the especially high press attention journals have not changed their practices in any way, and they still want to perpetuate the cycle. But I think that more people are getting their information about science from more niche publications that are spending more in-depth time looking at a field and, you know, bringing up more minor topics that are deserving of more attention.
My name is John Rennie. I'm a blogger at For Plus Blogs. I write The Gleaming Retort. Hypothetically, in the same way that the journals will impose an embargo saying, we don't want you to write about this before this date, what if journalists all around the world and all sorts of news organizations imposed their own sort of moratorium and basically said, we won't write about a new published finding for 6 months after it comes out? I mention this because my point is that if you think it through, the scientists, of course, will still know about it, so it's not going to be retarding the progress of the science. By the time we actually write those stories, we will get a much better perspective on how much those findings really held up well and what kind of cautionary statements we should attach to them. And of course, the public itself is not really being harmed in any way, because quite frankly, whether they get most scientific news right this moment or a better informed version of it some months down the line, really doesn't make very much of a difference to them either. It's also not like they're going to be waiting for science news. They'll still be just getting constant rush of science news all the time. Now, I don't really expect anybody to do this, and it's not as though there's anything bad about writing new findings up. The problem is it's the default mode of all science news. And in fact, within the world of sort of the commercial mainstream media, there are a lot of pressures that try to make that the only definition of what's going to be science news. And I just think that's impoverishing the communication of the science and really distorting it in a lot of ways.
SciCurious's blog is amazing. She has a lot of energy, and she's very funny, and she makes it really personable, and you're going to like the science that she talks about just because it's hilarious.
On Fridays, I do Friday Weird Science, which can be any weird concept in science, from burps to boogers to sex to whatever I think is really funny. My name is SciCurious, and I blog at Neurotic Physiology on the Scientopia Network. Well, my biggest post ever was whether or not masturbation can cure sinus congestion. I don't think that was my best post, but it certainly was very popular.
Lots of comments.
Lots of anecdotal comments, yes.
Okay. Did you come to a conclusion?
So far, it appears to work for about 75% of the respondents, but that is a biased representation, and also it appears to work for only 15 minutes or less.
My science of makeup post was very popular. It got a flood of comments, a number of which were kind of angry at me for supposedly not realizing the art of makeup.
What were you explaining in the makeup article? What was it?
I was talking about how the way that you generally use makeup, you know, excluding very, very dramatic, colorful makeup, happens to enhance natural signals of femininity and natural differences, gender differences in skin tone, contrast, etc., and that this is potentially why it, quote-unquote, works.
But I think the point here is that just because a word has a use in an everyday context doesn't make it an everyday word. Context always, always matters when thinking about whether something is understandable to your audience or not. So it's not just about labeling words as jargon, non-jargon.
I will ride people very hard about leaving jargon out.
Now, here at Science Online, one of the sort of sessions you did was sort of some tips about how to write. One of the nice things about that was the words you like to ban from news articles. Give us a flavor of what you think should never appear in scientific writing.
Well, I started this list I call the Index of Banned Words. And basically, I circle them in assignments, and I just say, I don't want to ever see this again. And it's getting to be pretty long. So, I mean, I never want to see the word methodology in an article. I don't want to see orthogonal. I don't want to see transmissibility when you could just talk about getting sick. Sometimes it's easy to forget who you're talking to. You know, when you're writing for The Guardian or for The New York Times, you're hopefully writing for millions of people. And so you have to think about that. What do those millions of people know about the subject you're writing about? Probably not very much in the details. So if you just start out at the beginning and use straightforward language and be clear about it, you can really actually get people to understand a lot of stuff. But if you just bury it in jargon, you've lost your reader, because they don't have to read you.
There's a quote from Mark Twain that I think we need to read at this point. He once wrote, "Substitute damn every time you're inclined to write very. Your editor will delete it, and the writing will be just as it should be."
Bora.
Bora is sort of the node to which everyone else connects.
Bora to me.
Bora is the greatest guy ever.
Bora is like a warm bath, really.
He's amazing. He is absolutely fantastic in every way.
And it turns out the same
exact same room.
Yes, where his
and
dad,
this really happened. You're not
this
just...
It didn't happen to Paul. It happened to a friend of Paul's. Yes.
Wow, that is weird.
At Science Online, we had a keynote speech by
Robert Krulwich,
who is a veteran journalist. He started out in television news. He's been National Public Radio. He has a radio show called
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
Yes. And NPR.
And he also has a blog as well on the NPR website. It's called Krulwich Wonders. And he will pick strange, quirky things that actually have nuggets of really important science in them. And he comes at them from a peculiar angle with a lot of artwork and animation and so on. And every post is surprising.
Like ferocious Argentinian ants. And you say, same, same, in certain ways. And that's the insight. I'm Robert Krulwich, and you're listening to the Guardian Science Weekly podcast.
And what do you make of that?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of it.
Both you and Jad are quite clear that this is not a science program.
He's very clear about that. I know it is, but I just don't say it very loud voice. Also, Jad has gotten very tired of science and really wants it to be a sports program. So I have to keep telling him, no, we can't do another hockey piece.
How would Radiolab cover something like this?
A meeting like this? Oh, I think we'd just go around and just listen in. And it would be very anthropological. I'd say, this is a group of people who cannot sit in a room and listen to anything without, for some reason, telling someone else in the moment about what they're listening to. Like, what is that about?
On Twitter or something.
On Twitter or something. Like, why can't you, if I'm going to show you a movie, why must you constantly be telling someone else, I'm watching a movie. Now the movie's getting better. Don't like this part of the movie. Here's another part of the movie. Like, who are you talking to? And why does anyone care? And why do you feel the need to do that? And so forth. And the behavior, and these are queer people, certainly. The behavior of these people would be the thing we would probably notice. And then argue about. He would tell me, well, that's a good behavior. I'd say, that's a ridiculous behavior. And it would kind of go that way. So it's like a little bit like it's we're two tourists traveling together on a cruise that never ends.
Hang on a minute. How about us Brits?
You've heard a lot of American voices, but in the UK, there's no shortage of blogging talent. Someone who was celebrated almost as much as Robert Krulwich was a young writer from London.
A lot of editors and a lot of journalists and writers that I know have seen blogs as almost a talent pool to draw from. I mean, we have people like Ed Yong, who's a fantastic science journalist. He does most of his work on the web. You know, when I want to hear about a new scientific discovery, I go and read Ed's blog first.
His was just about everyone's favourite blog here at Science Online.
I'm Ed Yong. I write a blog called Not Exactly Rocket Science.
In the daytime, Ed works at Cancer Research UK. At night, though, he switches persona and forgoes all sleep to write his blog. In an ever-growing constellation of science bloggers, Ed is the North Star.
The British scene is more heavily dominated by sceptical blogging, and there's probably fewer people who do what I do, which is trying to make more general science news interesting to a broader audience. And I get a sense that there are fewer scientists who are blogging about their own work as well.
Now, it's all very well, everyone writing all of this stuff, either America or here. Is anyone making any money out of this?
I don't think anyone is making a living out of blogging solely, but for some people it is supplementing their actual salaries. For some people that's a goal. I don't think it's a goal for everyone. Most people, and me included, we blog mainly because we love it. And if someone wants to pay us for it as well, then that's a bonus. But what you've got here is a massive ecosystem of people who really want to write, who may not have had opportunities to do so before, and who are just exercising that chance.
So I kept looking for Bora, and kept looking, and had just about given up hope. The final session had wrapped up, and I was making for a taxi to the airport. And then, after evading me for 2 days, there he was.
Bora is the hub, and we are all the spokes.
Bora is my blog father.
Bora.
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 Of course.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Bora, I'm going to get you.
Okay, you got me.
I've got you.
When I caught him, Bora was busy hugging as many of the parting bloggers as he could.
Just keep hugging. Keep hugging.
Keep hugging.
Thank you for coming.
It's so nice meeting you.
Awesome.
Yes.
Bye.
Thank you. Bora Zivkovic, I'm a blog editor at Scientific American.
In the time that you've been blogging, the science blogging world has rapidly expanded. It's changed. What kinds of things have you seen happening?
It's really changed, not just in size, but in many ways in style, because the earliest science bloggers came from political blogging, skeptical blogging, atheist blogging. It was very, very much a fight against creationists and things like that. What happened over the years is that more and more people came into the science blogging doing something very different, like research blogging, where you pick up a paper or two and kind of dissect them and explain them to lay audience. A lot of people who are not interested in controversies on politics, but they're excited about science and they just want to write about science to various levels. Some bloggers are really good at talking to kids and others are really good to talking to each other. So, you know, from kindergarten to postdoc, any level of reading level is covered by various bloggers. So it's got a little professionalized as well with all the networks and people learning from each other. It's not as Wild West as it used to be.
What makes a good blog in your sort of experience? What makes a blog rather than something for that you might read in a magazine or a newspaper?
Oh, it's hard. It's like porn. You see it, you know, when you see it. You know, it's like. You know, I read a blog post and it just makes me like, wow, I have to like retweet and share this link because I want other people to read it because I got excited reading it. It's just like any piece of good writing, you know, it's like when good writing just grabs you from the beginning and you can't stop reading.
I think people are waiting to hug you again.
Yeah, okay.
Are there specific things that you think are going to happen in the next few years for science blogs that excite you?
I think it's an exciting time, this explosion in size and quality and prominence and how, you know, science blogs are being treated better these days than, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when I started. It was like, you know, the blog was a dirty word. And now, you know, over the time, science bloggers have proven themselves and, you know, they know what they're talking about because they're experts in what they're writing about. And so they prove themselves over and over and over again to the rest of the public and to the mainstream media that they're to be trusted.
And then it was over. This extended family of nerds departed the Sigma Chi Center to scatter itself back across the blogosphere. But their conversations never stopped. Right now, on Twitter and on their blogs, they're all talking to each other, discussing ways to get better, arguing over the best sessions at the meeting, starting new spiky conversations, and already plotting next year's gathering, and anyone can join in. Here are some good places to start.
One blog I like is Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer, and it's astronomy-based, but he's also a big skeptic, and he's very much against the anti-vaccination movement, and so he sometimes hits on some other things.
Jonah Lehrer's Frontal Cortex at Wired.com is a wonderful blog because he is also a very literary person. He is a genius at coining metaphors and coming up with allusions from literature and art that can help explain very arcane scientific concepts to even a general reader.
I'm a really big fan of a blog called Gene Geek, so you can Google Gene Geek and you'll get straight to her. It communicates science in a way that everybody can understand while also having a level of technical detail.
For psychology and neuroscience, I would say one place to start would be a blog called Mind Hacks, written by Von Bell. He's a psychologist. Very accessible way to enter into the blogosphere, and something that he does very well is link out to all the other parts of the blogosphere.
I would like to recommend Laylabs by Brian Svitek. It's in the field of evolution. He writes about paleontology, which is not directly my field. I'm more into molecular biology. When a story hits, for example, about the giant stalks on Flores, and it gets covered all over the place, you need to go to Brian's place to get a big story on, because there were these things going on that these birds might have killed humans, for example, but Brian puts it into context, says that there's no evidence for that. However, we do have other evidence of fossils here, of humanoids that were possibly attacked by birds. So you get a complete story.
One I particularly like is John Hawk's weblog, it's called. He's the evolutionary biologist I just spoke of. He studies human evolution, and he has a very accessible, personal writing style. He explains things very clearly, gets in a lot of nice conversations with both bloggers and other scientists about his core interest, which is how humanity arose out of what came before us. Very lucid, enjoyable writer whom you feel you're getting to know as you read his science blog. John Hawk's, like the bird, weblog.
Carl Zimmer, who I was very excited to meet here at this conference, is a great writer, and he mostly writes about biology, various topics in biology.
I definitely recommend Christy Wilcox's Observations of a Nerd, actually. It's got so much excitement and enthusiasm, and it really brings you into wanting to like science.
A useful start to discovering this enlightening online world. All of those blogs mentioned are linked to from our blog. That's guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's where you can tell us what you think of this programme, and there you'll find links to 4.5 years of our archive. Of course, there are all of the Guardian Science blogs. Check those out at guardian.co.uk/scienceblogs. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.